again, listener. You're very welcome to episode 63 of Good Copy, Bad Copy, the B2B copywriting podcast. It is a packed episode this time. We are talking about international writing, both for translation and in English, whether or not your audience's first language is English. So we have a lot to talk about. As ever, if you have any questions or comments about this episode, please do get in touch. You can send us an email or a voice memo to podcast@radix-communications.com, or you can tweet us at radixcom. That's RADIXCOM. My name's David Maguire. I am creative director at Radix Communications. A little later on, you'll be hearing from some of my colleagues. But first, I spoke to Anya Jones of AJT Translation, all the way from Portugal via the magic of Skype, to see whether the things copywriters are told translators need are actually correct. So I'm joined all the way from the Algarve, I gather. It's Anya Jones from AJT Translation. Hi, can you hear me okay?
Hi, Dave. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too. How's the weather out there? I'm not remotely jealous.
Well, actually, I'm jealous of you guys because in Cornwall, the weather is much nicer than it is in the Algarve at the moment. Somehow the roles seem to have switched and you guys have lots of lovely summer weather and it's just raining here.
I'm delighted to hear that. I'm not going to lie. So thank you for joining us for a chat about translation.
It's a real pleasure. It's the first podcast I've ever taken part in, so it's a very proud moment on my part, especially with you guys. I listen to your podcast all the time, so it's quite sick to be able to actually be on it.
Oh, wow. Thank you. So, translation. I think it's something where we as copywriters we often hear, oh, well, this is going to be translated into 14 languages, so you must do all of this and you mustn't do that. And actually, we rarely get to talk to the translator themselves to find out how much of that stuff is actually true. So thank you for joining us. It's so useful to actually hear it from you direct. One of the questions I wanted to ask, what would you say was sort of the most important things that copywriters do need to bear in mind if they know their works can be translated into other languages?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. And just to say as well, for us as the translators, we very rarely get to speak to the copywriters either. So it's really nice if there is ever that connection. Mm-hmm. It's super helpful for the translators as well. But I guess the first and foremost thing is really for the translator is good copy. I know that sounds really silly, but as the translators, we're probably your most harshest critics in a way, mm-hmm. because during the translation process, we really dissect and we analyze every single sentence that you've written, you know, because we need to make sure that we understand it right and then also bring it across in the right way. So, you know, if we come across sentences that are, I don't know, a bit wishy-washy or there's sort of empty phrases there without making the point, just sort of alluding to it or not giving specific examples or poorly constructed arguments, that's kind of every translator's nightmare. And it really makes it hard for us to produce that translation that sounds really natural and fluid. It's almost like when, you know, you send a copywritten piece for translation, it's like the magnifying glass is on it. And so, yeah, good copy is basically the first and foremost thing you can do.
Oh, that sounds scary.
The challenge is on. But beyond that, I think one of the biggest things for translators is ambiguity. So if there is text, you know, that doesn't really clearly spell out the argument or makes the point and it just sort of implies it, that makes it really hard for the translator to know exactly what you mean. You know, as I said, it's very rare that we actually get to speak to the content creator to ask the question of, hey, when you wrote this sentence, X, Y, Z, what did you actually mean? And so it can turn into a little bit of a guesswork in, you know, for the translator, and that can lead to the meaning being lost in translation. If I think of the German target market, for example, Germans in their very nature are very precise and logical, and any kind of claims that you make really need to be backed up by specific examples. So you can't just say, for example, that you're environmentally friendly, but you also have to say why and how you're doing that. So kind of you have to be super specific when you translate for the German market, for example.
But that's really good practice in copywriting anyway, I guess. It's a lot of showing rather than just telling, which is a thing that we have to talk to clients about all the time, you know, kind of backing up what you say and saying why. So that's great. I mean, that's a really good discipline for us to get into. We often get told as copywriters, oh, this is this is going to get translated, so don't use any figurative language, don't use any phrases that are specific to English or British English in particular. Is that true? Does that make life difficult for you, or is it something where really, you know, if we say something like out of the frying pan into the fire, not that you would, because that's a cliche, but you know, if we use a phrase like that, is it something where it's often, you know, it's easy to find an equivalent generally, or does that make life hard for you?
I think it depends a little bit. If it's sort of in the longer pieces of text, then I think it's definitely fine to use idioms and figurative language. And in particular in marketing translation, you know, they're very useful tools in your writing toolbox. So, and the translators are generally very adept at finding local equivalents that will bring the meaning across really well. I think where it becomes tricky is if you were to build your entire marketing message around a figure of speech that doesn't translate well into another language. So, you know, especially if you then even go down the road of having visual imagery to go along with your punchlines or your slogans, that can become quite tricky. So if I just give you maybe a random example, you know, you have the saying to make a mountain out of a molehill.
Yeah.
In English, and imagine you have a company that solves a problem for their customers, and they turn it on its head and they say, oh, we make molehills out of mountains. And you then use that slogan throughout your marketing copy, and you might even have some imagery that goes with it. When that then goes to translation, you know, into German, for example, we don't say we make mountains out of molehills, we make elephants out of mosquitoes. You know, and
that's
so if
beautiful.
You then, yeah.
I much so prefer then, that.
And so, you know, if you then try and translate that when it seeps into every bit of copy, and, you know, your whole marketing message is around that one figure of speech that doesn't translate well, that can cause real problems, you know, just generally with the localization process. But in longer descriptive terms, I think a bit of figure of speech is really nice. And in fact, it sort of makes the translator's life a little bit more, you know, colourful. Oh. It's a bit more of a challenge.
Oh, no, that's interesting and good to hear. So you mentioned localization there. So we hear a lot about sort of translation, localization, even sort of transcreation. Are they all sort of very different things, or do they overlap? I mean, for the listener that doesn't quite get the distinction, what would the difference be there?
So between translation and transcreation, the way I tend to look at it is that on the one side, you have your standard general translation, and then you have marketing translation. And so your standard general translation is your non-emotive, quite factual content. And that could be anything. That could be the frequently asked questions on your website. It could be a privacy policy. It could be the help center content on your website, for example. Anything that's, you know, quite factual. And then on the other side, you've got your marketing content. And that is content that serves a very specific purpose in terms of evoking certain emotions in the reader, or, you know, get them to perform a certain action. And again, that could be like the main page, you know, the homepage of your website. It could be lead nurture emails, Facebook ads, ebooks, blogs, essentially anything that's been created with a sales or marketing purpose in mind. You know, and within that bucket of marketing translation, at the very upper end of it, we have transcreation, which is where we then move really into advertising. So for example, you have a new product, might be the latest Spider-Man doll or something, and then you have a slogan in English, and then as a German translator, you're given that slogan, but you're not really asked to translate it, but you're asked to come up with something similarly catchy in German. And so you almost move into copywriting mode, but it's, you know, from one language into another. And that's where I see transcreation. But what I think is happening in the industry and why transcreation is becoming a bit of a buzzword these days is, I think with the sort of the rise in machine translation and the hype about artificial intelligence, there's a bit of a shift in the perception on part of the buyers, so the translation buyers. So customers kind of tend to think that they can get any type of human translation that should be absolutely excellent, but at the same time, really, really cheap. And so they're only willing to pay the price of standard translation, but are expecting actually marketing translation or even transcreation. And so I think the translation industry is responding to that trend by calling your standard marketing translation really transcreation, to kind of communicate the value that marketing translation brings and, you know, why it's important to have that human translation, I guess. And then in terms of localization, I guess localization is more a term around not just the translation of the words on a website, for example, but also everything that goes with it. You know, the pricing on your website, the currency, the contact information needs to be localized to, say, somewhere in Germany or somewhere in France. So it's not just translating the words, but actually making the entire customer experience fit for the target market.
Ah, I see. That makes everything so much clearer. Thank you. And I feel your pain about the march of the robots. I think they're coming for the copywriters too soon enough. Worryingly soon. So I mean, we write a lot of B2B technical copy, or write, you know, around those subjects. So from your point of view, I was kind of interested to know, when you get sort of business jargon or sort of tech terminology, how do you make sure that that's accurate and that it's used in a way that's gonna, you know, ring true with the target audience in the desired language?
So I think we probably, as translators, go through very similar processes as you guys do as copywriters. So there's a lot of research involved. We check out the industry in general. We have a look at competitors' websites to make sure that we're getting the right terminology. And also, if we are able to speak with the in-country teams of a customer, so the German marketing team or the French marketing team, then if we can have the conversation directly with their marketing or sales guys, then that's the holy grail, I guess, of, finding out how people in that market speak. And those are the guys who would be using our translation to sell the product. So they would be the first ones on the front line to help us with that. But even beyond that, I guess, you know, there is different considerations for different markets. So a lot of the techie buzzwords tend to, you know, originate in English. And then different languages tend to approach the translation of these in different ways. So in Germany, for example, there is a general trend to use anglicisms, whereas in French, there is always that notion that we should try and translate and find the French equivalent. So if you even think about simple words like software, email, and community, in German, we call them software, email, and community. They're just but then if you go into French, they're called logiciel, courriel, and communauté. So they kind of, you know, they get translated. And that general trend then also moves into the more techie words, like, I know, talk about single sign-on, for example. Mm-hmm. In German, single sign-on. In French, authentification unique. So, you know, there is that as well, that you have to research a terminology, but then every single market might actually use that terminology in slightly different ways.
Goodness me. I could talk to you all day. there's so many things I want to ask. I mean, is there anything in particular that, you know, while you have the ears of B2B marketers and copywriters, that you'd like us to bear in mind that can make your life easier as a translator?
Yes, I do.
I thought you might.
So for me, or for the translators in general, it's all about context. So if you are able to provide additional context and reference material to your translators, then absolutely do so. And that's context in terms of who the text is actually aimed at and what its main purpose is. So if you can share information about the buyer persona you're targeting, and I know that, you know, for you as copywriters, it depends where you sit in the supply chain. If you are an agency like yourselves, you might not have that direct contact with the translators. But if you're an in-house copywriter, or if you're a marketing manager who happens to also write, then you will have all that information anyway. It's part of, you know, it's part of your job. So if you can share it with your copywriter, you can also share it with your translator, for sure. So the same stuff that you receive, the translator should receive as well. And also, you know, as
I wish
I said,
we did. it's not always the case, but yes, oh, really? I echo that. Yes, sorry.
But as I said, we go through the same research steps to ensure that we understand the product and how it works. And, you know, even as copywriters, if you're quoting particular studies or you've come across yourself, across useful websites during your research, then why not share them with the translators? Because, you know, we're sort of the guys at the very end of the supply chain, which is a bit of a shame. You know, we tend to get the copy really late in the process. Yeah. There's often like a super tight deadline. You know, everything is always English first. So the English is everything. Everything's perfect and within the deadline. And then, oh, no. Oh, yeah. We need to localize this as well into like 20 languages. And ideally, it should have happened at the same time as the English. So can you, like, by yesterday, you know? So anything you can do to help the translators is really great. And especially for the guys who are sort of, you know, in the marketing positions, they will find, like, in particular in big companies, so you have an English team that creates all this copy and then it gets translated. And then what happens is you have in-country reviewers. So your German marketing team reviews them to make sure they're okay. So if you can share any kind of reference material before the translation starts, what actually tends to happen is that the translations are better from the beginning, and that helps to kind of reduce those lengthy review cycles and the back and forth. And you know, wherever you save time, you also save money. So it's a win-win situation.
Oh, well, that sounds fabulous, and I'm sure that will be heard loud and clear by the marketers that are listening, and any of the copywriters too. I'm sure we can help to stick up for the translator. We know what it's like to be towards the end of the food chain, where all of the budgets and schedules are tighter than they might be. So we certainly feel your pain, Anya. Thank you so much for your time. That's much appreciated, and it's absolutely fascinating to get the translator's eye view of things. I hope the weather does improve for you in Portugal, but not too much.
Thanks so much, and thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thanks once again to Anya for being so generous with your time and your wisdom. As writers, it is really helpful to hear what a translator really thinks. But what's the copywriter's perspective? Fiona Campbell-Howes, our founder and lead copywriter here at Radix, sat down with Matt Godfrey, the head of our copy team, who writes for international audiences all the time, to find out whether it really is that much harder than writing for an English audience.
Thank you, David. And hi, Matt.
Hello.
So we're talking about writing for international audiences. And I guess one of the things that we often hear from clients is, this piece of copy is going to be translated, so make sure you don't put any flowery language or idiom in it that's not going to translate well. But do you think that's the right approach?
You're right, it is something we hear a lot. I think the whole idea of making things easy to translate is a little short-sighted, maybe. What you'll end up with, I think, is you'll end up writing in quite bland English, which then gets translated into bland Spanish, bland German, and bland Italian, and doesn't do anyone any favours. Mm. And really, any sort of decent translator ought to be able to localize what you're writing so that it retains the flavor and the message and the tone that you're trying to put across, and find kind of local equivalents for the language that you're using. So to my mind, you're better off writing something that's engaging in English and spending a bit of time and effort on localizing it properly so it's still engaging in local languages. Mm. And often, I think, it seems to me that it's a case that make it easy to translate actually means make it cheap to translate, because if you're not using figurative language and idioms and things like that, it's fairly straightforward to put this stuff through machine translation and leave humans out of it entirely.
Do you know, I'd never thought of that. I always assumed that everybody gets people, you know, local language speakers to do the translation. But I never thought that maybe clients take a copy and run it through a machine to translate it.
Yes, the machines are marching towards us all.
Yeah, and I think that kind of reflects what Anya was saying in the interview that she did with David, which is that, you know, a good translator can cope with you writing in your own native language as long as what you're writing is clear and your intention is clear. That's right. More what they look at rather than the words.
That's right, yeah. I think it's clarity is essential and precision, yeah, to help the translators, but also, you know, that's important things to have in your copy anyway.
Yeah, absolutely, just good writing practice, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, we've talked about copy that's going to be translated, but we also write for international markets where they still speak English, but obviously it's a different country and it's a different culture. What's your kind of view of what's the best approach to writing for other English-speaking markets?
Well, really, there's kind of two approaches. I guess one of the biggest English-speaking markets we often write for is the United States. And that's, I think for us Brits, is relatively easy. We're exposed to a lot of American TV, American films, American news. So we kind of pick up American idioms and things and patterns of speech, and we use them ourselves in everyday conversation. You know, we're quite familiar with them, and I think so when we're asked to write specifically for the US, which we often are, it's not that difficult to switch into that mindset. On a personal level, I also watch quite a lot of American sports, and so I pick up bits and pieces of kind of conversational phrases and things from the commentary and what have you. And it's also nice to get the chance to put baseball metaphors into my copy as well, which I don't get to do a lot.
So I think that's a really useful tip to kind of use, because we watch American TV and we watch American films, and lots of us watch American sports as well, and that's a really good way of getting under the skin of the language, although you probably could take that too far. So I know I've watched all 5 seasons of The Wire, but I'm not sure that I would really use a lot of that language in my copy.
You do have to remember the tone of voice of the client organisation. Yeah. Obviously, sometimes you need to be a bit more West Wing than The Wire.
Yeah.
And sometimes those idioms aren't appropriate for some clients anyway. It needs to be finely judged, but it's useful to have that kind of library of phrases and ways of talking that you're familiar with.
Yeah, definitely. And so what about writing for international markets that aren't native English speakers? What are some of the challenges there?
Yeah, so that's interesting. I'd say, you know, a large proportion of our work is written in English for non-native English speakers, or for a combination of native speakers and non-native speakers. We're often asked to write for this strange place called EMEA that nobody actually lives or works in, which is the whole of Europe, the whole of the Middle East, and the whole of Africa, and to try and capture every cultural and linguistic nuance across 2.5 continents would drive you insane. So we have to bear in mind some basic golden rules about writing for non-native speakers. Things like avoiding ambiguous words that can have multiple meanings if you're not a native speaker. So, for example, saying, once you have done this, then do that, instead of saying, when you have done this, then do that. The word once, of course, has two meanings. The word when only has that one meaning. Yeah. It's things like that. And precision, as we mentioned earlier. So if the language is precise and the structure of the sentences is precise, the meaning will instantly be clear to someone who doesn't have that language as their native language. It's about people not having to work too hard to understand your meaning. So when non-native speakers are reading in English copy, they're mentally translating it into their mother tongue and having to work to do that. And this flies in the face of what we were saying before about a good copy should be very easy to read and instantly kind of understandable. It shouldn't really feel like reading at all. But of course, when you're reading in a second language, it's always going to be a little bit of work. So we try and take some of that work from the reader by being clear, precise, unambiguous, those sorts of things. That doesn't mean that we can't use any figurative language. Sometimes that's useful and important to get in. But you do have to be careful about how you choose it and what you select, because any kind of idioms or things that you use, metaphors and things like that, they need to be understood internationally. And the danger is that you'll fall back into quite cliched things that can sound a bit trite, a bit hackneyed or banal, and don't get that point across. So it's a fine balancing act, really, between making the copy engaging and, you know, not too bland and dull, but also making it very clear, very unambiguous, and quite easy to read for non-native speakers.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think maybe one of the areas where we found particular challenge is when the clients ask us to be humorous,
yes.
So to bring some comedy into the copy.
We always like to bring the comedy wherever possible, as you know, Fiona. And it's a challenge always working on marketing copy and trying to, B2B marketing copy particularly, trying to judge the level of humour. But I remember a client saying to us on a piece that he wanted to it to be a kind of quite a humorous piece, and he said, make it properly funny, not British funny. And that posed something of a challenge. I don't think any of us were quite sure what the difference was.
Well, I think, and we could probably do a whole podcast about humour in B2B, but I think on that occasion, that was a French client asking us to write a comedy sketch to be performed by a team of executives from all different countries across Europe. So there was almost no way we were going to make something that everyone was going to find funny.
No, I don't think he was a Monty Python fan somehow. It's always difficult, but particularly, I guess that highlights that, you know, using idiomatic language, using figurative language, using humour, all of these things are tied into cultures. And the languages of different countries, and it's difficult to make something that really appeals internationally. As I was saying, you know, across EMEA and the United States and APAC, and you know, we're often writing for global audiences. It's the challenge for us as writers is to not confuse and befuddle and annoy people because everything's too British, but also not to lose sight of the fact that it still needs to be engaging and compelling and get people to take action and maybe feel something at the end of it. And it's balancing. Getting that blandness out that it's always tempting to put in when you're writing for a very broad audience.
Matt, thank you very much indeed.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Fiona and Matt. Believe it or not, that is almost all we've got time for. But before we go, it's time to induct another nominee into the Radix B2B Content Hall of Fame, which, if you remember, is where we talk about B2B content that we kind of wish we'd written, if we're honest. This time, it's our colleague, copywriter Nick Prescott, and he chooses something a bit unusual. Okay, so it's time to induct another nominee into the Radix B2B Content Hall of Fame, and I'm joined by Nick.
Hello.
Hi, it's your turn, and you've picked a one out of left field, I think it's fair to say.
It's a belter. So it's it was a blog that was written sometime last year for or by someone at Air Charter Service. So they're a company based in the UK, and they supply kind of like charter jets, private jets, that kind of thing, to presumably private individuals, businesses.
I'm liking this already.
Generally, people with a lot more money than we have to
speak
spend
for yourself
on travel. I saw this blog that talked about Donald Trump, Xi Jinping, Kim Jong Il,
all your favourite people,
all the best lads, and Theresa May and Angela Merkel, all these kind of big world actors, and just their planes they travel in week to week.
Suddenly the appeal becomes clear.
Like two of my favourite things, right? So what, politics and aviation.
Dictators and aviation.
Yeah, exactly.
You love a despot, don't you?
Yeah, I do love it. Together at last. And, you know, an air charter company or private jet company must be incredibly hard to market. I wouldn't imagine price is a big competitive advantage, because if you've got that kind of money to spend, you've got it to spend. You know, I'd imagine the equipment you're using is like the biggest thing. So unless you're a massive aviation nerd, you're not, and you know, you're a prospective customer, you're not going to be wading through catalogues of what this business jet has or doesn't have or what have you. So, I think it's almost mocking that fact that it's probably an incredibly difficult thing to market. So we're going to put together this fun list of dictators' jets, so you'll hopefully go with ours, you know?
No, that sounds hilarious, and it is. And I think they keep updating it all the time. They seem to always update it with new details and things. And it's incredibly long, and must get them all sorts of Google searches and social shares.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredibly long. And you can tell the research has been put into this. This isn't just like top five dictators' jets and kind of like a brief summary. This was really in-depth stuff that, I mean, some of the stuff I went onto Wikipedia or whatever to kind of just check it was true, because I was like, wow, that's quite interesting.
Well, like what? One fact?
Well, there was a bit about Angela Merkel's jet in there, and she's not in the news every day, right? It's not like Air Force One. And just some really niche facts about her plane that you would have to have dug quite a bit to find that stuff. So I really appreciated that.
Well, in that case, given that that warm nomination, I am more than happy to induct Air Charter Services blog around private jets of world leaders into the Radix B2B Content Hall of Fame, and we'll provide a link to that and also to Nick's analysis of it in the show notes. Thanks, Nick. That's very you, if I may say so. Well, unbelievably, we've run out of time once again. In the next episode of Good Copy, Bad Copy, we'll be talking about writing copy that works on search engines and other ways that data can inform what you write. If you have any questions or any tips to share, do drop us a line. You can email us at podcast@radix-communications.com, or if you email us a voice memo, John Kerrison has promised to wax his entire body, and he is seriously hirsute. You can find us on Twitter @RadixCom, and you'll find our website at radix-communications.com, where if you like, you can sign up for our potentially career-defining monthly emails. Until next time, live long, prosper, and give it one more proofread for luck.